This is Liberation Radio.
Capitalism needs poverty.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly last.
Whatever we could do, we're gonna do, especially in continuing to preserve this earth.
Each week, we bring you interviews, commentary, analysis, political developments, and struggles affecting workers throughout the country as a way to build the movement for socialism in the United States.
The revolution will be broadcast.
The only thing that will ever defeat racism will be the defeat of its parents, capitalism and imperialism.
Without smashing mass incarceration, working people of all nationalities cannot have justice.
Liberation Radio is brought to you by the Party for Socialism and Liberation.
Welcome to Liberation Radio. I'm your host, Sean Garcia. On this episode, we hear about updates in the struggle for marriage equality. We also get an update on the movement to free Miley Hampton, a young activist charged with lynching. But first, we speak with Eugene Puryear, national leader of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. He reports from the streets of Baltimore. Eugene describes the national campaign to drop the charges against hundreds of people who have been arrested in the Fight Back movement there. Having been in Baltimore last week, what would be your key takeaway?
I think the key takeaway for me from, you know, what I saw there is the unity of the community, unity and resistance, I think maybe the way to put it. I mean, the number one thing that people were telling you, and I was moving around a lot, especially on Thursday, and able to talk to folks, especially right up there around at Penn and North, which is where that CVS sort of famously or infamously was burned. Everyone was saying, you know, we're not thugs. I even saw a great shirt that someone had put together. It's a keep calm, I'm not a thug. And so at the end of the day, the attacks, both from that angle, sort of the cultural angle, the offending people, the verbal assault, if you will, to the physical assault of the police being there, I think really created a sense of community. You know, you would both see and be talking to gang members, for instance, who had longtime rivalries who were unifying. So I think if there was one takeaway, it would be that unity of the community that had been created by this resistance struggle.
And we heard a lot about the social devastation in Baltimore. What were your impressions of the broader context of the areas where the most unrest happened?
Well, you know, I saw one measure in Sandtown. So everyone who's watching is seeing things being burned, CVS on TV, that area, that Sandtown in West Baltimore, something that they faced about 50% unemployment. And it's, you know, it's clear. And you know, it's not like Baltimore is necessarily the world's most unique city, but without a doubt, the number of empty homes, I think it may be even upwards of 40,000 vacant. And these are like row homes, you know, not just apartments that are out there, the lack of grocery and food opportunities, the obvious unemployment that exists. I mean, you know, it's one thing to sort of hear about it in the abstract, but to be on the ground in Baltimore, it's really easy to see the social context of what's going on. I mean, we know that militarized policing is really a military answer to a social problem. The fact that the devastation of cities like Baltimore, the economic hollowing out of cities like Baltimore and others around the country created a vast train of social consequences that have to be contained because the government isn't going to solve them. Absolutely not, and certainly in a way that the containment is a part of their broader strategy. But that being said, of social control of oppressed communities, and that being said, it's 100% clear that that is the case when you're on the ground in Baltimore. It's 100% clear just looking at those aspects.
And what do you think was the relationship between the events of Monday, the so-called riots, and the other protests and activities in the city?
Well, you know, I think that's an important reality because I think that, you know, the two, they were related. I mean, there were some people who were looking at it in a negative way, trying to counterpose the two. And certainly they weren't, you know, it wasn't as if these protest groups were organizing the rebellion, but they stemmed from the same circumstances. And, I reject the idea that protests doesn't have to be militant. And in the context of a military occupation, even a lot of the nonviolent protests I were on, you know, I mean, there was a certain amount of militancy and risk in just being willing to challenge the police and the National Guard, when, you know, this is a state of emergency, so there's no real sort of normal rules to protesting. And when they can kind of do anything at any time and have literal military force behind them, even that is the case. But, you know, even beyond that, you could see that they were stemming from the same sense of anger, frustration at the role of the police and the broader and the role they play in sort of the broader ecosystem of social devastation that, that people are living in these neighborhoods, in these communities. And I think for sure that what happened in the uprising and the rebellion, I think, steeled the resolve of people to continue to fight. There were some people who thought that it was good and that it expressed the right thing. There were some that felt peaceful protest made sense. But I think one thing that was 100% clear is that what happened on Monday that resulted in that state of emergency and that curfew and that occupation that was entirely unnecessary, I think really steeled people to keep fighting because they didn't want to allow this movement for justice to Freddie Gray to be stopped by the military and the police.
And can you talk quickly about the national campaign to drop charges against people the hundreds of people who've been arrested in the Fight Back movement down there?
Yes. And so the ANSA Coalition, of which I am a national organizer with, as well as D.C. Ferguson, which is one of the main Black Lives Matter groups in the District of Columbia, I'm an organizer with them as well, have launched this petition to demand amnesty for, I think, just upwards of 300 people who were arrested. And we've seen the number one case of the young brother who broke the window of the car and has a $500,000 bail and is facing numbers of years in prison. And these cops that killed Freddie Gray only had run around a $350,000 bail. So, you know, the life of Freddie Gray apparently worth less than a police car window. So at the end of the day, and, you know, everyone says, oh, well, they value parenting, and they showed the video of the woman going to get her kid. And, you know, that kid who broke that window, his parents told him to turn himself in. So much for the state saying they respect parents trying to do the right thing and whatever. I mean, obviously, it's an absurd situation. So go to answercoalition.org, answercoalition, ANSWER.org, to sign that petition demanding amnesty.
Awesome. And what do you think is the general relationship between uprisings and social change?
Well, I'll say that President Obama was 100% wrong when he said during Ferguson that burning a car never got change. I mean, one really quick, easy example is look at the open housing acts and the fair housing that came in the latter half of the Civil Rights Movement. In 1965, when Dr. King started his Northern movement in Chicago, it was very contentious. And it got the issue of open housing, ending discrimination in housing, into the forefront of the conversation. But then it stalled because of the, you know, what some people call the white backlash of 1966. Mm-hmm. And then when Dr. King was killed in 1968 and over 100 cities went up in flames, then somewhat miraculously, that bill starts to move and ends up passing. You have in Detroit in the 1967 uprising, the fact that auto companies then started to hire blacks in large numbers. You had, after the 1964 Harlem uprising, programs like HARU and MARC, where the ruling class in New York City was pumping millions and millions of dollars into different social, cultural, political, and economic programs in Harlem and other oppressed communities in New York. So absolutely, the uprisings of people play a role. And I think if you look at all real liberation movements, Cuba, for example, in the socialist sense, India, in the, you know, more non-socialist national liberation sense, all elements, elections, uprisings, and in some cases armed struggle, strikes, I mean, all of them were used to win this liberation movement, certainly the Russian Revolution, the Chinese Revolution. I mean, all real, true mass movements that change societies, movements of tens of millions of people taking their own destiny into their own hands, use a wide variety of tactics. And sometimes they're unplanned tactics, like unplanned spontaneous uprisings, but they're still a part of the broader cry that creates the context in which the system cannot ignore the movements of the oppressed.
And we have a little less than a minute here, but can you talk about what effect you think Baltimore will have on the Black Lives Matter movement more broadly?
I think simply it is helping the movement grow. I think without a doubt, Baltimore helps to show that the movement might have been a little bit on simmer, but that it's still there. There's a lot of organizing going on at the grassroots level in many cities all across America. It's not dead yet, and I think Baltimore really renewed people's confidence as well as confidence in the fact that the movement wasn't dead as it was being portrayed, and also confidence in the fact that we could still get out there and intervene in the political conversation in a way that is substantive.
Thanks so much, Eugene.
No, thank you for having me.
Liberation Radio got the chance to talk with Zachary Wolf, attorney and professor at Georgetown University, about the marriage equality struggle at the Supreme Court and the discourse around the rights protected by the 14th Amendment.
I'm Eugene Puryear, and I'm here with Liberation Radio with Zach Wolf, writer, professor at George Washington University, and of course, author of a recent article on liberationnews.org on marriage equality. Professor Wolf, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
So I want to go to the topic of your article, which is marriage equality. And as for those who aren't 100% sure, the cases that are before the Supreme Court, what are they and what exactly is at stake?
Right. Well, people remember 2 years ago there was a lot of attention to marriage equality, and one of them had to do with the Prop 8 decision in California that wound up getting kicked out of the Supreme Court for sort of technical reasons having to do with standing. The parties that were bringing it, California, had essentially given up. And so the original decision got reinstated, but it didn't have any force or effect, didn't have any precedent for the rest of the country. The other case that was up there 2 years ago was the Defense of Marriage Act on the federal recognition. Defense of Marriage Act said that the federal government won't recognize a same-sex marriage, even from a couple that lives in a state that does recognize their marriage. And the Supreme Court reached the merits on that decision and held that the federal government had to recognize those marriages. That was, I mention that because DOMA has two parts to it. One is the federal recognition, the federal government won't recognize same-sex marriages, even in states that do. And then there's also the state level that says other states don't have to recognize marriages. So this year we have the state level recognition of marriages. Does the state have to recognize a same-sex marriage performed in another state if that couple then moves to Kentucky or someplace that doesn't recognize same-sex marriage? The other issue then is whether states are required to recognize same-sex marriage and perform them within that state. So there's two issues in front of the Supreme Court this year. Unlike 2 years ago, where they were sort of technical, almost tangential issues, this year it's the big questions. Does the state have to recognize same-sex marriage? And if they decide against that, if they decide no, a state doesn't have to perform same-sex marriages, then the second question comes into play of even if Alabama doesn't have to recognize it, do they have to then recognize it when a couple moves to their state from California?
Absolutely, and that's a great legal summary, and I should have mentioned in my opening biography that Professor Wolf is also an attorney, hence his deep knowledge of the legal issues. So what has a lot of people, the way it's being spun is that this the reason they had to take this case is because of the movement that's been happening around this country for marriage equality. How do you feel about that assertion?
I think that's absolutely true, that the pace of recognition of same-sex marriages is amazing, how quickly it has come to broad popular acceptance and judicial acceptance, right? So by and large, couples have been winning in the courts, not universally, but by and large. And by and large, they've been winning in the court of public opinion, right? We have three states now that have adopted marriage by voter initiative, by popular vote. And we have another 8 or 10 that have done it through legislative enactment. So it's not just the courts that are bringing it in. So the court is kind of pushed to it. There's also, you know, what you asked before, what's at stake? I didn't mention the claims that are being advanced, and I think that's part of it too, that the court has an obligation to hear people's claims of civil rights violations. And these are really horrible stories that, and fears that people have, right, of not being able to visit a spouse in a hospital, right, not being able to be recognized as a co-parent. There are states that won't recognize co-adoption, so you can only be adopted by one person unless the other person is married to the original adoptive parent. And so that means that in couples where if that adopted parent dies, those kids are legally strangers to the other parent who they've known for who knows how many years, right? People who have spousal benefits through, you know, health care benefits to their spouse suddenly are told that they've got to change states by their employer. Are they going to lose their health care coverage? So there's really important pressing concerns that people have that the courts have got to get into.
And to maybe go a little bit deeper, and I think you've touched on this, but maybe to draw it out directly, I think for the layperson, you look at the law, and a lot of it is, to a degree, interpretational. And so what role do you think movements have, or if they have any, if you don't think they do, in terms of sort of shifting the frame of the broader public that leads to different interpretations by many judges, lawyers, others in the legal realm?
Right. Verrilli, who's the Solicitor General of the United States, sort of the chief litigator, the chief talker in the U.S. Supreme Court on behalf of the United States, mentioned that a lot of this can be traced back to the decision to strike down the sodomy laws in Lawrence v. Texas. And so suddenly people were able to come out of the closet, right? It was no longer a hidden aspect of life, and people could come forward and say, we want to make lives together, or we are being denied our rights. And so suddenly now you have people who formerly had been quiet, who have been silent, who have been in hiding, were able to come and be part of the political process. And so as that has taken force, it's taken greater attention for political organizers and political organizations. You know, there's a little bit of controversy and question about what is the role of the marriage debate in the liberation movement and the broader liberation movement. And it's definitely true that you can't let marriage stand for everything, right? It's not going to solve a whole lot of problems. It is not liberation. There are a lot of people in the LGBTQ community for whom marriage is just not the highest priority, right? With that understanding, though, there are also a lot of people who are moved to action by marriage. And there are probably a lot of people who were on the sidelines not even thinking about LGBT rights, who are now thinking of it, thanks to the marriage equality movement. So I cut the movement a little more slack for going with that, right? If it were actually taking energy away from more radical organizing, then I think that would be something to be really worried about. My sense is that that's probably not true, right? The people who are behind the marriage equality movement weren't going to be behind a broader liberation struggle, right? David Boies wasn't going to be fighting for liberation on a more radical scale anyway, right? But the fact that it is now part of the conversation, people are beginning to think about, well, why are we treating gay people differently from straight people, right? Why do we treat some families differently from others? And so it allows for at least a broader consciousness and awareness of it, right? So it's cyclical. On the one hand, the courts are moved by the movement of the people. On the other hand, the legal action, and even though it's a sort of technical accommodationist, not the highest priority for everybody, it still forces open conversation, right? Forces people to think about things that maybe they hadn't been thinking about before.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so finally, should we, or can we at this stage, hazard a guess as to how this case is going to go, or are there just too many moving parts?
I think that we're going to have marriage equality, right? I'll go out that far. It could be wrong, right? It could, and you know, everybody is kind of assuming that that's the way it's going to go. It's not certain that that's the way it's going to go. There are important legal questions about how do you get there, right? Mm-hmm. So even if the marriage equality demand wins, there's at least a few routes that you can get there. One is to say that it's a demand for marriage. Marriage is a fundamental right. The government can't deny access to fundamental rights without a really good reason, and they don't have a really good reason, right? That requires saying that the gay couples are just demanding marriage as a recognized, long-standing fundamental right. The court doesn't want, some of the conservatives don't want to do that, but they want to say what these people are demanding is access to gay marriage, which is not a long-recognized fundamental right. I think that they probably lose on that on the precedent of the anti-miscegenation laws, that when couples of different races were coming forward demanding the right to marry, the court said, you're being denied access to a fundamental right. They didn't say, you're trying to get a right of interracial marriage and that doesn't have longstanding fundamental rights, which it didn't at that time, right? It really wasn't defined historically in that way. So if we win in that way, if the marriage equality side wins in that way, then you get marriage but nothing else, right? It's limited to marriage. And this is where sort of the overlap with larger demands, maybe more pressing demands for some people, comes into it. That it's also possible that the court would rule that treating people differently on the basis of sexual orientation is suspect and that deserves heightened scrutiny. And if it does that, so it's not the fundamental rights kind of analysis, but rather the differential treatment analysis, then all kinds of LGBTQ discrimination becomes suspect, right? So it's not just marriage, but employment standards, all kinds of things that are gonna come in beyond marriage, and that could have a much broader impact for people who don't particularly care about marriage, but do care about being able to get security clearances or government jobs and be out in government jobs and things like that. We don't know if they'll go that route, right? And again, there's a couple ways that they can do it on the heightened scrutiny or the simple rational basis, which is what they've been doing so far. So the lawyers are looking more at how do we get marriage equality, right? I mean, I think there is largely an assumption that we will get marriage equality. The question is, are they going to do it in a narrow way, which has the least impact outside of the marriage context, but it requires them to say that you're not asking for gay marriage, you're just asking for marriage, and it's all the same, which for some conservatives don't want to say that, right? Or are you going to push the moderates on the court to have to do it in this way that has a broader impact? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And is there anything else you'd like to add on the issue?
Wow. I mean, I think that it's important to recognize that marriage is important, that it's not the be-all, end-all, but that it does allow for an attention to state-sanctioned discrimination in a way that other kinds of efforts and movements haven't, right?
Absolutely, and we were pleased again to be joined here on Liberation Radio with Professor Zach Wolf, an attorney as well as a writer and professor at George Washington University, and please check out his recent article on marriage equality at liberationnews.org. Professor Wolf, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
You're tuned into Liberation Radio, and you can check out our website, liberationradio.org, on Facebook at facebook.com/liberationradioshow, and on Twitter at the handle Liberation Radio. Finally, we hear about the national movement to free Black Lives Matter activist Miley Hampton and the recent victory coming from the decision by the Sacramento District Attorney to drop the felony lynching charges.
The Sacramento District Attorney has decided to drop the felony lynching charge against Answer Coalition activist and PSL member Miley Hampton. Sacramento authorities had targeted Hampton, a key part of a rising youth movement against police terror in Sacramento, in an attempt to place a chilling effect on the activities of those seeking progressive change in the city, particularly around issues of racist oppression. For the third time, the diverse community of Sacramento came out to show their support for Hampton, as well as their opposition to the continued targeting of Black activists opposed to police brutality in Sacramento and elsewhere. The crowd gathered outside the courtroom at 8:30 in the morning, ready for all charges to be dropped. Shortly before going in, Miley was informed by her lawyer that the DA would be dropping the felony lynching charge, but leaving the misdemeanor resisting arrest charge. To this, she pled not guilty. As the new date was set for May 21st at 8:30 in the morning, Miley walked out, followed by her supporters who had filled up many of the seats inside the courtroom. The crowd then gathered in the lobby and went outside to celebrate the new developments. This was a victory made possible in large part by the people. Community support was important in showing the DA that to charge a black woman with lynching is flat out absurd. It took the efforts of the community to make sure that Miley did not lose 4 years of her life to a corrupt criminal justice system. This is the same system that fires tear gas and rubber bullets at those seeking answers to police murders. The struggle for justice and liberation continues. Miley still faces an unjust misdemeanor charge and could spend up to a year in jail, in addition to being put on probation and being given a large fine. This is ridiculous. The DA should drop the charge now. Activists should not be targeted and free speech should not be limited because it is a threat to the structures and institutions of white supremacy. The Party for Socialism and Liberation is calling on everyone who values justice over racism, oppression, and exploitation to join the fight to demand the Sacramento DA drop the remaining charge. Go to answercoalition.org to sign the petition with this demand. And if you are in Sacramento, show up to the next court date on May 21st at 8:30 in the morning at 720 9th Street. We need to spread this fight all across the nation. An injury to one is an injury to all. Only by standing together can a movement that seeks to uproot police terror grow stronger.
That's all for Liberation Radio. I'm Sean Garcia. Please remember this program is available free for broadcast by community and public radio stations. You can encourage your local radio station to air Liberation Radio. They can visit liberationradio.org for details. And again, tune in next week for more from the Struggle for Justice.
Listening to Liberation Radio, a weekly program from the Party for Socialism and Liberation. You can find us online at liberationradio.org to listen to past shows and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Some of what you heard during this program are Creative Commons licensed compositions. Our theme music and some music segments were performed by Six Fingers and used with permission of the artist. Liberation Radio is produced by the Party for Socialism and Liberation to help build the struggle for socialism in the United States. The PSL is a party of activists and organizers. We are in the streets at the demonstrations and picket lines, opposing cutbacks and attacks on workers, standing up to police brutality, fighting for immigrant rights, and struggling against racism, sexism, homophobia, and all forms of bigotry. We stand in solidarity with oppressed peoples around the world resisting imperialism. We believe the crimes of capitalism call for a new kind of society, and we are committed to fighting for it. To find a PSL branch near you, see our upcoming events, and learn more about how you can get involved. PSLweb.org. Again, that's PSLweb.org. Also, the PSL's Liberation newspaper online at liberationnews.org, where you can read our news articles and analysis or purchase a subscription to the print edition. Thank you for listening.